grateful to have from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, Jason Fitchner. Heidi was actually the person who knew of Jason's expertise on hidden costs of tax compliance and arranged for him to be here today to speak to us. He is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center. His research focuses on Social Security, federal tax policy, federal budget policy, retirement security, and policy proposals to increase saving and investment. His work is featured in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Investors Business Daily, the Los Angeles Times, the Atlantic, USA Today, as well as broadcasts on PBS, NBC, and NPR. And soon he will be broadcasting as a guest on Red Meat Radio, 860 AM, Utah's big talker. That's 10 o'clock, 8 to 10 every Saturday morning, rebroadcast every Sunday morning. And you can win two $100 gift certificates at gastronomy restaurants. So without any further ado, we'll hear from Dr. Fitchner.
Howard, thank you for that introduction. I appreciate it, and thank you for the invitation. And also to Mike and to Heidi for having me come here. I also realize that I'm not the last speaker standing between your afternoon nap. You just had lunch. You're probably tired, and I see folks are starting to go out. So I will try to make this quick. Howard promised you that you'd be out of here by 1:30. I'll try to not make a liar out of him. But this presentation is called The Hidden Cost of Tax Compliance, but also could be called The Hidden Cost of Taxes and Spending Policies. A lot of things we talk about you've seen today have been sort of these static costs. What are the direct costs of having a tax policy or a spending bill? But there are a lot more things that go into it. In the presentation before lunch, Misha mentioned an estimate from the National Taxpayers Union that the hidden cost of compliance or tax compliance is $234 billion. What if I told you that was a very, very conservative estimate, and that if you think about compliance costs as an economist, not just the cost you put into preparing your tax returns, the time paying for accountants, but the lost opportunity cost of putting that money to some productive use, that you actually could be looking at upwards of $1 trillion of hidden costs from compliance. And we did a study where we updated several studies that have been done before to try to sort of figure out what these costs are. So there's accounting costs, and we give a range. Several studies have gone out and tried to estimate, what did you pay for H&R Block? What did you pay for TurboTax? What did you pay your accountant? You did your own taxes. How much time did it take you sitting at the table, the kitchen table, to do your own taxes? And how do you value your time? Do you bill it out hourly? Is it a daily rate? And they try to get an estimate for these accounting costs. These are the top left box, and the ranges are from $67 to $378 billion. So it's a wide range. We all know we spend time complying with the tax code. But there are other things, these economic costs. And economists like to think more broadly about these opportunity costs, the money foregone. What about the business you didn't create? Or instead of putting your accountant to fill out your tax return, you could have hired another worker or invested in a business. These ranges are even greater, between $148 and $609 billion. And the ranges are very wide because it depends on how you value your time. Do you value your time at a minimum wage? Do you value it at $30 an hour, $150 an hour? Those things are very sensitive to the estimates. But what it tells us is that the cost of compliance is not zero. Taxes have more than the cost that we see in the revenues. It's also this effect on businesses, and we'll start seeing it affects personals, it affects corporations. It also has effects on hidden costs when thinking about other things like governance and democracy. What does taxation do for democracy? The far right box is the IRS's own figures. This is what they call the tax gap. What they're saying is there's $452 billion that should be collected that they're not collecting. It could be for a variety of reasons. It could be because of fraud. It could be because the tax code is so complex that people make honest mistakes. Who here actually does their own taxes? Raise your hands. Good. I assume you spend 30 minutes and you're done, right? It's very complex. How often are you sitting there with a pencil and paper? Who does it in pen, by the way? Yeah, nobody. All right, so no one does it in pen. You're all doing it in pencil because you make mistakes. These things add up, and when the tax code gets so complex, it's very easy for people to have a hard time complying voluntarily. So we need to think about this. Senator Cruz recently gave a speech where he said the cost of compliance was $500 billion. The Washington Post has a column called Fact Checker, where they try to call out politicians who are lying about facts. Senator Cruz used my study as one basis for his estimate and one by Art Laffer, famous for the Laffer curve, for another. And they called and said, Senator Cruz said it's $500 billion, Jason, what do you think? And I said, wow, this is the first time a politician has been conservative, where they could have gone to a high rate instead of to a trillion. He went halfway and said $500 billion. And they were surprised. They're like, well, why would he do that? I said, I don't know why I picked a more conservative number. But I think he was trying to look just at accounting costs, not the entire cost of what it means to comply and the economic costs. But the range is important. And so the Washington Post gave him two Pinocchios. Basically, out of four or five, they said it was two because he wasn't very specific in saying he was just talking about accounting costs instead of talking about compliance costs. To give the Post some credit, they did give Hillary Clinton four Pinocchios recently, where she said that illegal immigrants are paying more in taxes than U.S. corporations. So they called her out on that, so the Post was being kind of fair. But there's a lot of things that are hidden in some ways when we think about tax policy. There's a lot of things that are spending through the tax code. These are so-called tax expenditures. Not all tax expenditures, by definition, are bad. The Obama administration thinks that a lower capital gain rate is a tax expenditure. It's not. It's a lower rate because we pay a taxes first at the corporate level, then pay at the individual level. So we have a lower rate for that reason. But there are some things that are spending-like procedures. We do the tax code. The earned income tax credit's a great example. The child tax credit's another. Where we have, and subsidies for ethanol, for example, are all things that are done through the tax code, where the government could be sending out a check through a federal agency, but instead reduces it in taxes. What that means is that we actually have a government that's even bigger than we think it is, because we're spending so much on these subsidies through the tax code. And this distorts it. And as you see from the graph here, both the number and the dollar cost of spending through the tax code has been increasing rapidly. And this spending through tax code creates some perverse incentives. And when you think about the hidden costs of tax policy, again, it's not just the static costs. It's not just sort of these compliance costs we talk about. But it's also what does it do to our society when we create unintended consequences or perverse incentives. Once we start giving something with the tax code, it's very, very hard to take it back. What that means is you create a big incentive for lobbying. Lobbying now is one of the biggest expenses we start seeing in Capitol Hill. I actually live on Capitol Hill. And it is amazing when Congress is in session, I can't go for a run around the Capitol because of all the lobbyists that are up there trying to do rent seeking for their various causes. Some are just educational and well worth it, but some are really trying to lobby for rent seeking to get government favors. And this shows up in the tax code. What we see now is there's almost 14,000 registered lobbyists in D.C. This number went down a little bit a few years ago because the Obama administration said they weren't going to hire lobbyists to work in the administration, and now it's gone back up again. The recent estimate I heard flying out here on NPR was up to 14,000 registered lobbyists. This creates a growth in the spending in lobbyists. Think about the money we spend on lobbying that could be used for business activities, hiring employees. I'm not saying that lobbying is bad. I'm not saying it's evil. But in some ways, it doesn't seem as productive. But we've gotten to a point now because of our tax system and the hidden costs of compliance that lobbying is now one of the most profitable things for a company to do. One of the jobs I had was working for Arthur Andersen. I did what's called transfer pricing. I helped corporations set global transfer pricing standards so they could basically minimize their worldwide tax obligations. I worked for Arthur Andersen in the late 1990s. It's been almost 20 years. I was billed out at $275 an hour. That's almost 20 years ago. I can tell you I was not that productive, but when I saved a corporation $1 million in taxes, I was the most profitable thing they were doing. Why would you build a new business operation and build new and hire new employees when the rate of return on the margin is 5 or 6%, when you can make a lot more than that hiring lobbyists and tax economists to get your tax bill down? This is an ineffective system, and this is sort of the hidden cost we have because of the high rates and because we actually have a lot of spending in the tax code and the government's picking winners and losers. This sort of leads to the idea of fairness. And you've heard a lot of discussion recently about whether or not the tax code's fair. Are the rich paying their fair share? Are corporations not paying their fair share? Is the deck stacked against those who can afford lobbyists? You guys are a very educated group. You're here because you like taxes. They're not boring. Taxes are fun. Just think federal taxes for a minute, federal income taxes. So don't think payroll taxes. Don't think estate taxes. Don't think your personal property taxes. Just what you file on your 1040. So your income, your capital gains, your dividends, farm income, I think it goes into 1040. And then rank people who file tax returns by the highest earner, say Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, down to the lowest. And let's look at the top 1%. What share of the total amount collected by the U.S. government do you think the top 1% pays? What percentage? 90%. So what do you think the public thinks it is? the public thinks it's close to zero. What it actually is around 40. So what I've done here is given you sort of 3 years. 90 was high, but I like where you're going. But the top 1%, I have 3 years here. The IRS is not just slow sharing data with states, they're slow sharing data with the public. The most recent data we have is 2011. The 11 data sort of matches the 7, so I've just kept this because 2007 was before the financial market crash, 8 was the crash, and 9 was sort of a recovery. But what you sort of see is, again, the top 1% is paying 40% of federal income taxes. The top 10 are paying 58, top 10 are paying around 70, top 25, 85. The top 50 are paying 97%. That means the bottom half of tax filers, these are people who actually file taxes, pay taxes, are paying about 2.3%. I get a lot of calls from the New York Times, the Washington Post, saying the rich aren't paying their fair share. What do you say about this? This is the 1% versus 99. And I say, well, the top 1% is paying almost 40% of the federal income taxes. What do you say to that? And they go, oh, that's obvious. They have all the money. So the next question for you. Think about all the money we earn in the U.S. economy, adjusted gross income. So take your wages, your capital gains, your dividends. Again, put it on your 1040, add it all up to a number. What share of all adjusted gross income do you think the top 1% gets? Because if they're getting 40%, then maybe the system is actually fair. What do you think the top 1% actually has as a share of adjusted gross income? 16.9 right now. It's going back up to around 20. Someone who said 20 was basically on the dot. They have 20. So they're getting 20% of the income, they're paying 40% of the taxes. And think about this in the top 10%. The top 10% to go back, they're paying 70% of the federal income taxes, but they're basically earning 43% of the income. I say this to the New York Times. I say, well, all right, I get it. I understand that. But those 1%, they're really, really rich people. They make a lot of money. So it's okay we tax them. So now let's do a little bit of an exercise. Let's sort of take income again and think about the floor. If you make zero, you're at the bottom. If you're making millions, you're at the top. What is the basic number, the minimum amount of money you need to be included in that rarefied air of the top 1%? How many millions do you think you need? So I've heard not millions. Okay, so how much? So 360, 400. What about the top 10? Go 400 and 250. So to give you an idea, the top 1% now is about 340,000 to 2009 data. The 2011 has gone up back to about 400. But the top 10%, again, those who are paying 70% the taxes, it's $112,000. This also, by the way, is tax return data, which means a tax return could include an individual or a married couple filing jointly or two filing single. It's return data. It's not broken out. What this means is that if you have a public school teacher making 60 and a firefighter making $60,000 a year who get married and now making combined 110, congratulations, they're rich. This is sort of the perception problem we have in the United States right now, is that perception becomes nine-tenths reality. And we fight this perception and this hidden sort of cost because you have politicians saying the rich need to pay their fair share, they're not paying enough, they need to pay more. Any sort of tax reform out there that tries to reform the tax code, that tries to stay at least revenue neutral, has to hit the middle class. Because you're not going to get the revenues from the top 1%. The bottom half, really about 47%, don't effectively pay federal income taxes because they're getting an earned income tax credit or a child tax credit. So all the money is sort of in the middle. And a lot of people don't understand that when the politicians say they want to tax the rich, they mean you. They mean the American working family, that middle class out there, that is just sort of getting along. And this becomes the problem we have right now because, again, for any of you lawyers in the room, I took a pre-law class in college, and one of the first things, and the only thing I remember learning about it is possession is nine-tenths of the law. If you have something that basically is yours, someone's got to prove it's not. In politics, perception is nine-tenths reality. I spend a lot of my time trying to fight the perception that the rich aren't paying their fair share, or that they have all the income, or that the taxes aren't regressive. They're very progressive right now. I have to do battles with people with Social Security reform. Social Security people come and say to me, it's a very, very regressive system. Why do we have a payroll tax? We should just lift the cap so people pay more. And I say, well, it's not regressive if you include the benefits you're getting as well as the payments. Then it's a very, very progressive system. So the thing is trying to fight these sort of perception issues, and that's what we're dealing with all the time, because now we're getting to the idea of what are we actually paying, what are the rates? This is the average, and I say it's effective tax rates, not marginal, but the effective tax rates. Even though economists like to focus on the margin because that's where behavior is made, it's important to point out that the top quintiles, the top 25%, basically already have a 25% tax rate. This is on the federal side. So add in your payroll taxes, add in your state taxes, and you can see how the tax rate goes up, where again, the lowest it's 0.8%, and again, the middle is at 12.6. So we basically have a system right now, the top rate, the top effective rate is already a quarter, and that's on the individual side. We've had a lot of discussions on corporate taxes as well, and that came up today. On the corporate side, the United States is again the highest in the industrialized world. We're number one, baby, something we can be proud of. But that's, of course, not true. The high statutory rate is not an effective rate, but what you have is we have various sort of things in the tax code. Again, we have various deductions and credits for various activities that the government chooses to select, whether it's ethanol credits, whether it's investing in oil and gas credits, whether it's certain bonus depreciation items for manufacturing. The idea is we pick winners and losers, which vary film credits, which basically benefit some industries over others. So you have some industries whose effective rate is actually quite low, others have an actual effective high rate, but the margins where we made our decisions. And what we see with corporations now is that instead of trying to invest in the U.S., they leave and go someplace else. Again, the idea that President Obama wants to have an executive order to stop inversions is actually only going to increase them or find some other way for corporations to move money overseas. And that's what's happening. And Senator Henderson this morning mentioned something that made me smile. She said, corporations don't pay taxes, only people pay taxes. 95% of the public doesn't actually understand that. They look and see corporations putting money overseas and say, oh my gosh, they're traitors, they're not patriots. What they don't realize is that corporations don't pay it. Again, we pay it. People pay it in the form of higher prices. They pay it in the form of lower or reduced wages. Or for owners of businesses or investors, stockholders, it's a lower return on your capital. I've always been very upset when unions go out and say, raise the corporate income taxes. What they're saying is raise the taxes on our workers. Short run and long run makes a difference. In the short run, you can put a tax on a corporation. Maybe they can't adjust it quickly enough. Maybe it can go in prices. In the long run, businesses make decisions on where to invest, and taxes affect the long-run decisions. The Congressional Budget Office did a study where they said over the long run, 60% of the corporate tax burden is borne by labor. So 60% of the corporate tax we're not putting on labor. You want to know why our wages are stagnated right now? Why is our economy 6 years into a recovery and it's not growing? It's because we have so many regulations and taxes. Why should businesses want to invest? They do self-employment instead. And now we have taxes that are making self-employment harder. So in some ways, these taxes on businesses are a tax on people, and that's what's sort of holding back our economy. And again, these are kind of the hidden costs for tax compliance that we don't often talk about, but should. I want to talk a little bit about sort of some spending side, because there's no such thing as a free lunch, and there were some discussions this morning about some spending programs, whether it's Medicaid expansion or something else. What you see here today is that the total state expenditures have been rising for the last 14, 15 years, and you'll see the federal share and the state share. The federal share has gone up. The states are staying sort of constant at 30%. These are sort of in real dollars. But the idea is as government sort of grows, the state's got to pick up the same share, but still more dollars. So as the economy grows, as businesses grow, as everything grows, as government grows, the states have to take up a responsibility. The federal government's now putting a lot in. States right now are highly dependent on federal dollars. For most states, Medicaid is the single largest budget item they have. Even though the federal government picks up a large share, the states run the Medicaid system. So there's an old joke that if you've seen one Medicaid system, you've seen one Medicaid system. There are like 56 of them when you include the territories. My guess is that the federal shares are going to start changing. There's been a lot of discussion about how to control federal spending. We've seen it in discretionary caps. That means the states are going to have to pick more and more of this up going forward. And again, we've also looked at this adjusting for inflation, and you'll see that the share for healthcare programs and non-healthcare programs are both rising in dollars, and those dollars are, again, adjusted for inflation. But look at sort of the healthcare costs. Those are going up, up, and up, and they're going to continue to go up, up, and up. There has been an abatement in the increase in healthcare cost inflation. It has not gone down. It has slowed. Why has that happened? If you listen to the administration, they will tell you that's because of Obamacare, which means that the slowdown occurred before Obamacare even passed, which is an amazing feat to accomplish in legislation. The biggest issue is probably because we've actually had some recessionary effects. Some health care is actually in some ways discretionary. People look at their pocketbook and say, I can't afford to go to the doctor, I don't want to go. That brings down health care costs. When the economy picks up, health care cost growth is going to increase. That's going to, again, shift more of the cost burden onto the federal government and as well as the states. So there's no such thing as a free lunch. Once you give a benefit, you can't get it away. I think the House Speaker said something this morning about doing a pilot. And try it for 2 years, and after 2 years, if you don't like it, you can get rid of it. What federal program do you know that we've canceled in the last 20 years? They get bigger. Think about Social Security. Social Security Disability Insurance is another one. That started out, when we first started Social Security Disability Insurance, it was only for those who were over 50. Now it affects children and workers of any age. These programs expand. Think about the original Medicare and Medicaid. They're now expanded. Government programs don't shrink. They expand. They get more expensive. So you really just can't try something and then pull it back. Once you give it, it's going to stay. And that's why there's, you know, we have problems in Greece right now. And that is an old joke about beware of Greeks bearing gifts. I would say beware of HHS secretaries bearing gifts. The Obama administration is really trying now to get coverage numbers up before the administration ends and sticking the states with the bill in the future. So be wary of this. This also leads to another hidden cost, which is what we call improper payments. You've heard discussions of fraud, waste, and abuse. Fraud we know is illegal. And there are fraudulent activities that go on in tax policy, in taxation, but there are other things that are just confusion. There's just waste, there's abuse, there's improper payments where someone makes more than they should and then they still get a benefit and they, we can't find it in time. So what we have here is sort of dollars of improper payments as well as the percentage. Actually, Medicare fee-for-service is one of the largest ones when it comes to dollars. 10% of what we spend on Medicare is actually considered in some ways improper by the IG for HHS, meaning someone got a payment they shouldn't have gotten entitled to. Then you get to the earned income tax credit, which we spend about $40 billion on the EITC, about $14.5 billion of it is improper. A lot of that is actually fraud. But 24% of what we're doing on the EITC is improper. When you start doing these government programs, again, this goes back to the commissioner's discussion when it comes to taxation, when money's out there, some people actually really do deserve it, and we should make sure they get it, but there's also an angle of fraud, waste, and abuse, and we've got to do all we can to control it, because that means there's less money to spend on other places. But again, these are sort of the hidden costs, not only of tax policy, but also sort of on spending programs in general. I'm often asked whether or not Democrats or Republicans spend more. The answer is yes. Spending's a bipartisan issue, and you'll see this is sort of per capita. So again, it's per person. So even as the economy grows and the population grows, we're still spending more per person going up. Some of the course in the later Obama years and the last year Bush, President Bush, was because of the recession. But still, the trend line here is up. We have some recovery when the economy picked up and some spending went down because of the congressional budget caps that went in the sequestration. But generally, the trend is for spending to keep going up on a per capita basis. And again, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Someone mentioned this morning that the states have to have a balanced budget. They can't print money that the federal government can. The federal government can print money, and it does. And what you see is over time that we generally have an issue where the federal government runs a deficit. For a few years in the Clinton administration, we did have a surplus. But the trend line going forward now are for deficits as far as the eye can see. And those are, again, in billions of dollars. So we're getting back to the point where we're going to start having $1 trillion annual deficits. And the reason I sort of bring this up is because there's this sort of idea that states might be able to get some money from the federal government, and that's considered free money, and you should just take it. Well, if the federal government's paying for the states, where's the federal government getting it from? Taxpayers. Are states not made up of taxpayers? It's just shifting from one state budget to a federal budget, which means it still goes back on state taxpayers in some way, shape, or form in higher taxes, or it comes into the idea of deficits. Deficits are an annual flow. What do deficits lead to when you think about it on a stock basis? Debt. And debt's got to be paid by somebody. This is U.S. federal debt. This is a percentage of GDP. So you can see even if the economy grows or shrinks, their debt happens as well. The red is what's called debt held by the public. This is debt that's basically you and I could buy, foreign governments like China buys. The Federal Reserve is included in the debt held by the public. The rest, the blue, is basically debt that's owned by the government to itself, like Social Security bonds. But if you think that Social Security is going to have to at some point, we're going to make that whole and we're going to pay those bonds back, then gross debt's what we're trying to look at. And right now, our gross debt's over 100% of GDP. Anyone know what the GDP figure is for the United States right now? It's our gross domestic product. $18 trillion, which means if we all worked for one full year, didn't pay any bills, didn't buy anything, we could pay our debt back in 1 year. We owe one full year of economic output in our debt. If you look at sort of the outlying tail years, you see it looks like it's kind of falling down a bit. These numbers are from the Office of Management and Budget, so the Obama administration. And again, it's GDP. They assume sort of a low interest rate, economic recovery. But what happens, look at it in dollar basis. So this is now U.S. dollars. And what you'll see is that gross federal debt and debt held by the public basically continues on as far as the eye can see, because we're adding $1 trillion a year. Have I depressed you yet? So one of the things the House Speaker said, which also sort of resonated with me, is he said, in some ways we're making decisions and policy that are not just for a year, they're generational. Who has to pay back this debt? I hope it's not going to be me. I also don't have any kids, by the way, so I'm in sort of in favor of putting more and more debt on so that your kids have to pay it and not me. But think about the idea of generational. Deficits are annual. Debt is the accumulation of deficits, but that's up until today. So we've got this going on today, but we have made obligations. We've made promises. We've made promises to the states on Medicaid. We've made promises to the seniors on Social Security and Medicare. If we're actually going to pay all those, do you think we've got the money for it now? We don't. These are called an unfunded liability, which right now is estimated at over $200 trillion. What that means is if we had $200 trillion and could put it in the bank today, that would then generate enough money to pay our unfunded liabilities going forward for the next 75 years. We are not $18 trillion in the hole. We are $200 trillion in the hole. This is the accumulation of sort of all this hidden costs of tax policy and spending decisions that we've made, and it's coming to roost at some point. At some point, we've got to pay it. To leave on sort of a high note, the time for reform is now. What I thought was interesting this morning is Congressman Stewart mentioned that one-third of the federal budget right now is discretionary. Two-thirds are mandatory, meaning two-thirds of the federal budget are sort of walled off from the budget process and the appropriation. We don't talk about it. We don't debate it. It's just an autopilot. Just one-third of it's what's discretionary for the 12 appropriation bills. When we look back historically, in 1970, about 50% of our federal budget was discretionary. Now it's one-third. You now have 535 people in Congress fighting over a diminishing share of total outlays. Think that makes them nicer to work together? Part of the problem we've had with budget process and why we haven't had a good budget system lately is because people are fighting over more and more of diminishing dollars. You start watching the talk shows on the weekends, and you have members calling each other names, yet expecting to show up on Monday morning and work together. It doesn't happen that way. That's sort of why we're seeing more partisanship in some ways on the Hill, is because we're letting mandatory spending crowd out our ability to have discretionary spending and control this. But now is the time. Some members are concerned about growing entitlements. The Social Disability Insurance Trust Fund is actually going to become insolvent in 2016. Most people are familiar with Social Security as just being a retirement fund. That trust fund goes insolvent in 2034, 17 years away. So people are saying, we need to reform Social Security, but no one's really focused on it now. But the Disability Trust Fund, that goes insolvent next year. In fact, it goes insolvent right around November of 2016. What else is happening in November of 2016? Presidential election. None of the candidates are going to want to touch this. So the House is trying to do some reform on this now. This is sort of a segue using DI into larger entitlement reforms. We'll see what happens with the Affordable Care Act decision with King Burwell. The Supreme Court should have a ruling out next month in June. That could change the dynamics and also give the ability for Congress to do some changes on the ACA potentially. A lot of people want to do budget process reform. And again, corporate tax reform is also in some ways on the front burner. We now have Democratic senators. So there are some Democratic senators who understand corporate tax issues better than Republican senators. Sherrod Brown from Ohio has seen his manufacturing communities diminish because they're going overseas. And they're telling us because of the corporate tax rate. The rate's important. We now have Democratic members and senators coming to us and saying, how can we effectively lower the corporate tax rate? They realize that not even on a dynamic basis, but on a static basis, that'll probably create revenue on a behavioral effect. So they're trying to figure out how they can do this, and they're talking to us. Corporate tax reform is a big possibility. I'm not sure we can do it with President Obama in office, but I think it could be something that could really happen coming quickly in January of 2017. And with that, I pretty much kept to the promise to get you out of here on time. Thank you.